It's been 6 months since Amtrak train 188 crashed at Philadelphia's Frankfort Junction, killing eight. I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. What's changed in that neighborhood that's adjacent to the tracks? WHYY's Tom McDonald went back to take a look.
Pete's Clown House was the epicenter of media activity after the train crash, when literally hundreds of journalists camped outside 24 hours a day for about a week. Ron Bourdon owns the breakfast and lunch restaurant and is surprised to hear it's been 6 months. He says in short order, the neighborhood was back to routines.
I couldn't believe it when he walked through the door and told me that. Nothing at all. Same neighborhood. Been the same neighborhood since I've been a child here. Business as usual around here.
Joe Brown comes to the Clown House every weekday for breakfast. He says in the aftermath, it was a fight to get in. Now he can easily claim his spot at the counter. He says the neighborhood also is back to normal, with the exception of tighter security around Frankfort Junction, where the crash happened.
They actually cleaned it up back there. They fenced everything in. It's all new gravel. You can't walk back there anymore. It's secure. It looks much nicer back there.
Also sitting at the counter was George Orth, who agrees not much has changed.
Oh, they did a good job cleaning up. They did an excellent job. It really looks a lot better.
Owner Ron Bourdon was happy when the media decamped and his regulars could get in easily. He says he feels the crash shouldn't have happened.
Just horrible. Just a horrible situation. I think it could have been avoided, but it's not my say.
The fence around the tracks is stronger. The gate's locked with a sturdy chain. Behind it, you can see all the tracks and overhead wires that had to be replaced. But unless you ask about it, people near Frankfort Junction barely mention the Amtrak derailment. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
Let's take stock of railway safety 6 months on with Plan Philly transportation reporter Jim Saxa. Jim, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Jim, Amtrak 188 accelerated into a steep curve in Philadelphia, reaching 106 miles an hour. Now, that's more than twice the speed limit on that section of track. Essentially, what's been done since that crash to make Frankfort Junction curve safer?
Immediately following the crash, Amtrak was ordered to put speed limit signs all along the Northeast Corridor, and including that area. Before then, the engineers were largely required to memorize the entire route, which you can imagine is difficult. And while we don't know exactly why the Amtrak 188 was speeding, we do know that human error could have been one of the causes.
That investigation is still ongoing?
That investigation is still ongoing and will probably wrap up in about 6 months, around the one-year anniversary of the derailment.
Now, it's widely thought that had this system called positive train control been implemented, that train couldn't have gone 106 miles an hour. Refresh our memory, what is positive train control and what's the status of it being utilized on these corridors?
Yeah, positive train control is a safety system that Congress mandated back in 2008 on all heavy railroads following a deadly commuter rail crash in L.A. The way it basically works is it uses GPS and radio technology to pinpoint the speed and location of each train and will automatically enforce the speed limits on the rail. And by enforce, I mean it will automatically brake the trains.
Sounds like a analogous version to air traffic control for trains.
In terms
of automatically sensing where each train is?
Yeah, it does a lot of the similar sort of things there. And what positive train control really does is it prevents human error. If an engineer isn't paying attention, if he's distracted and the train's going too fast, it will warn him and then it'll automatically apply the brakes if he doesn't do anything. Something like that could have prevented the Amtrak 188 derailment.
So what are the impediments to implementing the system?
Congress actually recently extended the deadline. The original deadline was the end of this year, but only two railroads, SEPTA being one of them, were on pace to meet that. It's been extended back to 2018. The reasons why primarily have to do with money and a sort of technical difficulty getting the radio spectrum frequency needed for the system. A lot of the larger railroads had to negotiate with multiple entities in order to acquire or buy the radio frequency.
Is Amtrak behind the curve relative to other railroad systems, either in the United States or in Europe, for example?
So Amtrak is on pace for the parts of the Northeast Corridor between Boston and Washington, D.C. that it controls for the end of the year to have it all implemented.
Including the Frankfurt Junction curve?
Including the Frankfurt Junction. However, that does not include a section of railroad that's controlled by the Metro North Railroad between New Rochelle, New York, and New Haven, Connecticut. That railroad says they won't even begin testing their system until sometime in 2016.
So is there a consensus among the key players that this will be implemented by the target date, 2018?
I believe so. But when this bill, when the bill was originally passed back in 2008, a lot of people said they'd hit this original deadline of 2015, and it was extended.
Jim, thanks for bringing us up to date on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Plan Philly transportation reporter Jim Saxa. Volunteers in Camden handed out information on New Jersey's Good Samaritan law this week. If you're with someone who's overdosing and you call the police, the law protects you from prosecution on drug charges. WHYY's Joe Hernandez caught up with some of those volunteers.
This actually explains what the Good Samaritan law is.
It was a cool and overcast morning in Camden, but people still filled the streets near the Walter Rand Transportation Center, where several bus and rail lines meet. Volunteers in reflective vests were handing out bright red cards, about the size of a business card, that said, "See an overdose? Call 911 immediately." Patty Dorenzo of the Camden County Addiction Awareness Task Force helped organize the walk. Her son, Sal, was found dead in a car in Camden after overdosing in 2010.
You know, I know in my heart that these were streets that my son, when he was struggling, was probably walking on, and it's hard for me, but, you know, I wish, I guess at the time that Sal were alive and struggling, there are people out on the streets doing what we're doing today, raising awareness and letting them know that, you know, we're here to help and we care.
It's one of a handful of tactics police and advocates in Camden County are using to respond to a recent spike in overdoses. One of those overdose victims was Max Huffnagel, who died just 2 months ago. His father, Steve, along with many members of his sheet metal workers union, were among those handing out cards.
I don't know what the answer is. That's probably the worst thing of all, is meeting other families and people that have children that are struggling, and there's nothing really I can say. I don't have an answer. I can't just say, oh, we'll go just do this, or look, here, call this number. It doesn't work that way. That's the hardest thing about this, is I don't have an answer for someone else.
Police and advocates say this walk will be the first of many. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Turning to this evening's headlines, customers not pleased with their Comcast cable service join others who praised the company during hearings at Philadelphia City Council today. Kia Hinson of the group Action United says that Comcast should be a better community partner and help the city's poor.
I know that I was oversold and scammed by Comcast. I'm sure many other people have also been trapped in this vicious cycle. We need city council to force Comcast to make Internet Essentials the affordable, reliable internet program it claims to be.
Comcast officials say customers who don't want their service have a choice, and they're willing to work with the city to make improvements. Details of the franchise agreement are still being hammered out between the city and the cable giant. The five female members of Philadelphia City Council, along with the National Organization for Women, are calling on District Attorney Seth Williams to fire three of his prosecutors. They were involved in the Porngate email scandal. The emails were uncovered during an investigation by Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. She now faces criminal charges for allegedly leaking secret court documents to embarrass one of the three prosecutors, Frank Fina. Councilwoman Cindy Bass says she's not defending Kane, but acknowledges the role she played in bringing the emails to light.
No matter what people may feel about Attorney General Kathleen Kane, the fact of the matter is, if she had not uncovered this information and made it public, this would have been swept under the rug and we would know nothing about it.
The district attorney's office says the three prosecutors were disciplined and ordered to take sensitivity training, but will not be fired. It notes these emails were exchanged before the prosecutors joined the DA's office. Fina is among a group of plaintiffs who just sued Kane in the Philadelphia Daily News for defamation over that scandal. Clearing skies, 57 degrees at 6:16. You're listening to NewsWorks tonight on WHYY. Tonight's low, 48 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, high 58, but wind gust of 35 miles an hour will make it feel much colder. Saturday, mostly sunny, breezy, high 50 degrees. Sunday, sunny, high in the upper 50s. This is WHYY. Still ahead, outgoing Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter generally gets high marks for professionalizing the zoning and development process in the city, but
even though they're done ethically, even though the process is better in many respects, the end results of these developments, they look a lot like they looked before.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Cabrini College is proud to support WHYY, now offering part-time doctoral degrees in organizational development and educational leadership. Cabrini can help you earn a PhD or EdD in 3 years without giving up your life. Their faculty and small classes help to expand your knowledge and professional network while giving you the tools to advance your career. More information on Cabrini's professional doctoral programs is available at cabrini.edu/doc.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY, music that speaks the voice of America. The Philadelphia Orchestra and Yannick Nézet-Séguin perform Aaron Copland's Appalachian Spring, plus the world premiere of Hannibal's One Land, One River, One People, with choruses from around the community. Tickets at philorc.org or at 215-893-1999. This Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, an American celebration with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Philadelphia's 99th mayor, Jim Kenney, will be inaugurated into office on Monday, January 4th. In advance of that transition, NewsWorks Tonight is embarking on a series looking at the legacy of outgoing mayor Michael Nutter. First, let's assess city development. And for that, I'm joined by Inga Safran of the Philadelphia Inquirer and Plan Philly's Jared Bray. Inga, Jared, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Inga, how about offering a refresher on what Mayor Nutter inherited 8 years ago?
Planning and zoning were very, very big issues because the street administration had gotten a reputation for pay-to-play for developers and lawyers and various other people making campaign contributions in the hope of getting some favorable treatment. And the planning and zoning system looked very, very broken. And Michael Nutter campaigned very strongly and very effectively on saying he was going to fix that and to professionalize the zoning board and the planning board and the historical commission.
And in the ensuing years, what grade would you give him on that specific metric of eliminating pay for play or professionalizing the development?
Well, department? I think without a doubt, this is one of the most ethical administrations that I've seen. So I give him A for doing things in a professional way and not favoring people because they gave campaign contributions. It's really been an amazing transformation. I would give him a much lower grade for effective planning, zoning, and preservation because the great sad irony is even though they're done ethically, even though the process is better in many respects, the end results of these developments, they look a lot like they looked before.
Jared, I see you nodding your head, presumably in assent with what much of Inga is saying. To what extent do we factor in, though, that 1 year after taking office, Philadelphia, like much of the nation, was in the throes of a recession? Did that complicate or set back any well-intentioned plans that Mayor Nutter had?
I actually think that in terms of being able to rewrite the zoning code and make some of the planning policy changes that he wanted to make, the fact that development sort of slowed down a lot during that period helped them put together policies more quickly because, you know, in the middle of a building boom, people don't want to start changing stuff around, changing laws around. But now that it's the construction industry is huge right now, and now that it's come back, I think that people are starting to be able to test whether or not the policies, the new zoning code and things like that are actually creating better results. And I think Inga's right that in terms of the actual design of buildings and the way they interact with the street, I don't know if the zoning code change has actually improved those specific outcomes. I think that there's been this perception among city officials over the years that they're just desperate for any type of development they can get, that Philadelphia was on the brink of like just being cleared out completely at the end of the 1980s. And so anytime anybody wants to build anything here, they're just like, thank you, thank you, thank you. Mm-hmm. And I think that sort of attitude needs to evolve into, well, you know, we're not just going to take anything and be thankful for it anymore, but I don't think it has yet. I think there's still sort of at the end of this attitude that any development is good.
Let's talk about bike infrastructure. It's blossomed. Do we credit Nutter, at least in large part, for developing that?
I think we do. The mayor deserves props for expanding the bike lane network, and the bike lanes on Spruce and Pine in particular were really transformative, and that's changed drivers' attitudes about bicyclists, and the introduction of bike share has been a huge success. I also think the mayor deserves a lot of credit for parks, for renovating parks, and that's really important because those kinds of amenities are so necessary as the city's population increases again. People want places to go and socialize, and the city has to provide them high-quality parks to stay competitive.
Lastly, I'd like to ask each of you in turn, in regard to work left undone, if you had the potential to do so, what might you prioritize for Mayor-elect Jim Kenney in terms of development? Jared?
I just wrote a story this morning, actually. Well, I didn't write it this morning. It came out this morning about Nutter's preservation legacy, and I think that there has been a lot of work that didn't get done during the last 8 years in terms of protecting some of the city's most important landmarks, and not just its most important landmarks, but it's, you know, it's sort of the vernacular architecture of the neighborhoods. I think that especially during a building boom, which has occurred during the latter half of Nutter's career as mayor, there needs to be really thoughtful attention paid to the city's historic resources, and I don't know that all that attention has been paid.
Inga?
I think we need to revisit the tax abatement. It's been a very powerful tool, and it's definitely fueled a lot of this new housing development, but it's a very crude tool. And when you're giving out abatements to people spending, you know, $2 million on a house, I mean, that's just crazy. I think we could refine the tax abatement, and we could use it to support preservation and support other goals that we have, investment in neighborhoods that haven't seen a lot of investment.
Inga, Jared, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
Inga Saffron of the Philadelphia Inquirer and Plan Philly's Jared Bray. Upcoming episodes in our series focusing on the legacy of Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter will take up taxes, as Inga Saffron just mentioned, in addition to sustainability, business in the economy, crime, poverty, and livability. When industry dies, its defunct facilities are a liability. Either maintain, modify, or demolish. All options are pricey and complex for cash-strapped cities committed to honoring the legacies, however painful, that these relics represent. The city of Bethlehem's struggle typifies the Rust Belt experience, but with an atypical outcome. Keystone Crossroads' Emily Previty reports that it might all amount to a waiting game.
Brian Toseland is using a blowtorch to shape a piece of glass at the Banana Factory Arts Center in South Bethlehem.
It's more of a tusk, like an animal tusk.
This used to be a banana distribution warehouse. It reopened as it is now 10 years ago, and at the time, it really boosted momentum for an arts district. Except across the street, Bethlehem Steel was closing. The home of the nation's largest shipbuilder was suddenly its largest brownfield site. 2 decades later, much of the property's revitalized, and its SteelStacks Arts Campus is getting urban design awards. The property's most distinguishing feature?
The blast furnaces are 23 stories high, and they're almost a feature in the landscape.
That's architect Antonio Filsilva, who designed the elevated walkway that lets people get close to the blast furnaces. He's worked on other Rust Belt redevelopment projects.
In other cities, structures that are very similar to the ones in Bethlehem were torn down because there was no way at that time of maybe being able to reuse them.
Columbia University real estate professor M. Leanne Lockman goes deeper. She says there's a healing process relatively universal among post-industrial cities.
It takes 20 years to cleanse an area. And that's really what happened here.
Lockman says people often are too angry to think about legacy or preservation when the town factory first folds. And 20 years isn't always enough time. But at the end of Bethlehem's 20-year time block, gambling had arrived in Pennsylvania. The Las Vegas Sands Corporation expanded into the new market on the former Bethlehem Steel site, and the casino is now the strongest performing in the state. That sounds like luck, or at the very least, the often elusive financing vehicle coming through in a major way. Phil Silva says it was even more than that.
One of the things that is unique about Bethlehem Steel was that even as the company was facing its own demise, they actually paid for creating a master plan.
That did not happen at the company's other sites, maybe because some executives live in Bethlehem. Lockman led the jury that picked the site for the Urban Land Institute's Global Excellence Award.
It's intended to recognize projects that have replicability.
Lockman admits things really fell into place for Bethlehem. Then she again points out that waiting period. Community leaders used that time to plan. They visited redeveloped industrial sites and lobbied for a federal brownfields designation and admission into state tax break programs. This created a more desirable business opportunity, so there wasn't that risk of desperation Phil Silva's seen elsewhere.
People are looking towards the very basic necessities of what will move the city forward. So usually people are not so much in the mind of preserving something, but mostly in the mode of survival.
So memo to other cities looking for a more prosperous future without losing their legacy. Pride, planning, patience, persistence, all required for a start. Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focused on Pennsylvania cities, as well as their problems and potential solutions. You can contrast Bethlehem's revitalization with other cities, including Philadelphia, at keystonecrossroads.org. Also, check out Changing Spaces, the project's third TV program. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. This weekend, the Philadelphia Asian American Film Festival will feature short films from the Muslim Youth Voices Project. We'll meet some of the young filmmakers on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
The University of the Arts supports WHYY and is hosting a graduate open house Saturday, November 21st. It's an opportunity to learn about UArt's master's programs in studio art, museum studies, art and music education, design for social impact, product design, jazz studies, theater, educational program design, and educational technology. UArt's graduate open house, Saturday, November 21st, 2 to 5 p.m., 211 South Broad Street. Details at uarts.edu.
On the next Fresh Air, signing away your right to sue. New York Times reporter Jessica Silver Greenberg says Supreme Court decisions now permit fine print in customer service agreements for everything from cell phone service to nursing homes that force consumers to take complaints to binding arbitration, preventing them from joining in class action lawsuits. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
Drexel University's Dorn Seif School of Public Health supports WHYY and encourages listeners interested in improving population health here in Philadelphia and around the globe to attend a graduate open house on November 21st. It's an opportunity to learn about the benefits of a public health degree from Philadelphia's accredited School of Public Health. Registration for Drexel's November 21st graduate open house at drexel.edu/mphopenhouse.